National Guard of California, advanced to command of a regiment with rank of colonel. First business experience as salesman for wholesale grocer in San Diego, later sales manager for the same concern, entered the life insurance business June 25, 1925. That's 43 years ago, the life insurance business. Was successful in personal production, producing over a million first full calendar year in business, 1926. Then he's been experienced as a district manager, as a manager, and heading his own agency, which he now does in Los Angeles. Although he's really retired, he's not retired either. Keeps going. Joined the Connecticut General Life Insurance Company in Los Angeles as agency manager in 1934. Built the agency production from 58th ranking to second in the company standing. Last year, as manager, or rather 1959, the agency production exceeded 31 million, ordinary plus ranking second for company in accident and health. The agency had over 135 million ordinary in force plus 158 million group life. Well, I'll go on down. He's had quite a life in the insurance business, $1 million round table, estate planning, occupied his own building in 1951, was awarded in 1956 the Will G. Farrell Achievement Award as the man in the insurance business who contributed most to his countries outside the duties of his own business. Past chairman of the General Agents and Managers Conference of NALU. In 1960, was appointed director of agencies for the Western States to direct his company's expansion program. And in 1962, he retired to head the Walter G. Gastel and Associates Life Marketing Consultants. In all of these years, he has been, as a businessman, helpful to Christian organizations, some of whom are represented in this room, in their deferred giving programs, and especially helping to get donors to give larger gifts. We've asked him to speak on that theme this morning. Walter G. Gastel.
I'm delighted to be here and have a part on this kind of a program. A program concerned with giving. Because I recognize a basic law of life that getting comes after giving. That in the economic system of which we're a part, one must give to get. And that'll happen here in this meeting today. If I have a dollar and you have a dollar and I give you mine, then you have two and I have none. But if I have an idea and you have an idea and I share mine with you and you yours with me, then we both go. I'm delighted to be here and have a part on this kind of a program. A program concerned with giving. Because I recognize a basic law of life that getting comes after giving. That in the economic system of which we're a part, one must give to get. And that'll happen here in this meeting today. If I have a dollar and you have a dollar and I give you mine, then you have two and I have none. But if I have an idea and you have an idea and I share mine with you and you yours with me, then we both go away with two ideas and both are richer and neither is poorer. And that's the kind of a meeting that we're here for today, I believe. I believe we're here for another reason, and that is because we want to grow. We want to grow in our capacity to do better that which we have chosen to do tomorrow than we did it today, and we're hopeful that we're doing it better today than we did yesterday. And I'm sure that we all recognize the basic law of life, that life itself is growth. That the end of growth is death. That one cannot stay good unless he's constantly striving to be better. I used to tell the boys who worked for me in an estate planning operation as they went forth to do estate plans, to diagnose, analyze their problem, and offer a solution that every time they did this job, that every job they do must at one and the same time be the best job they've ever done and the poorest job they ever will do. I used to buy gasoline at a service station near my office, and they subscribed to a service, one of these pep me up services, sort of a morale building thing. I never forget that I drove in there one morning to buy some gasoline, and they had a new sign up for all the employees to look at and read the little caption under it. And here was a little tiny tot. He wasn't too big, and he was straightening up just as stiff and stretching to be as tall as he possibly could up against the door casing. And along the door casing, there were marks which had indicated how tall he was in past years. And his mother was there with a ruler on top of his head and about to put a mark on the wall casing for this birthday. And the caption was, "Growing isn't just for kids. We all grow, either growing taller or smaller, by the thoughts we think and the things we do, and constantly trying to do better." Never forgotten. You know, we get to thinking that physical growth is in our youth, that mental growth ends when we graduate from the highest level of scholastic training that we take, and that growing stops both physically and mentally at a certain stage in life, and that really growing in capacity, growing in knowledge, and growing in spirit never truly stops. So I think it's a wonderful thing that an organization such as this would appeal to men such as you to gather together at least once a year to share an idea and to take a time to review these basic facts, that growing isn't just for kids, and that what we've been blessed with and learned, we have the privilege of sharing, and that in sharing, we really grow tall. Now, I assume that you're all here for a number of basic reasons. First, that because you desire to increase the effectiveness of the particular mission that you've chosen to fulfill in the remaining days of your life, to reach all those goals. Second, that you all recognize the fact that the accomplishment of the goal is going to be the combination of people and processes and facilities, and that these all in our economic system cost money, and that if you're going to do more, you must have more to do with, and must find the best way. I'm going to assume that you're all here because you feel an urgent need to raise more money at less cost in both your time devoted to money raising and in the effort necessary and the cost of raising those funds. I must assume that you all get now in your particular organization somewhere between 10 to 20% of your total income. I mean, 80 to 90% of your total income from somewhere between 10 and 20% of the donors. This is a statistic pretty generally accepted in most organizations concerned with raising funds. I know that in the life insurance business, of which I was a part for many years, we recognize the fact that 15% of all the life insurance purchased in America and owned by Americans, 85% of all the life insurance owned in America was purchased by 15% of the people. We recognize the fact that in this great country of ours, somewhere around 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth, and the rest of us work for them. They enjoy 90% of the income and have 90% of the capacity, if it can be properly tapped, for giving. Therefore, you're properly interested in what can we do to reach this potentially larger giver, to attract his interest in our particular program and the worthwhileness of it, to wrap him up in interest and activity in it and tap some part of his giving. And therefore, I've been assigned the subject for this meeting, getting donors to think and give bigger. So much of what I know about soliciting funds, so much of what I know about life and dealing with people, I came out of the life insurance business. While Ivan has identified some of my activities, I just like to identify one in particular, because there is a close parallel between approaching this top economic bracket of society, the larger earners, the people with the larger wealth, the people with the larger capacity to buy most anything, and the people to make the larger gift. There's many, many parallels that I'd like to draw for you here this morning. I'd like to say that I have the privilege and the honor to be asked to talk again and tomorrow, and I'd like to divide my remarks into two parts. First, getting ready for the job, and then secondly, some of the specifics of the job. And so this morning we'll talk a little bit about getting ready for the job. In approaching any particular problem or any particular subject, I learned a long time ago that there's a pretty good pattern to follow. First, be sure that you understand the problem. And so we'll talk a little bit about problem identification. What is the problem, so that we each understand it? And then secondly, I'd like to talk a little bit about problem fixing. Whose problem is that problem? In life insurance selling, using a parallel, we used to say to people, the big trouble about a life insurance man and failing to make the sale is they're so excited about their solution to the problem that they never allow the person to recognize or to really feel that he has that problem, that he must do something about that problem. Build that first before you trot out solution, because people don't want the solution until after they recognize the problem. People don't go to doctors because they may get sick. They go to doctors because they are sick and want to get rid of the pain. And they pay any price to get rid of the pain. You can say to a man, just a little illustration, you could die tonight. That's a fact. And you know, if I never deal with facts in my relationship with people, if I never deal in opinions, we never can disagree. You and I can disagree over and over again on our opinions. You can say it's black, I can say it's white, when actually it's gray. And the longer I say it's white and you say it's black, we can disagree and argue. But it's neither black nor white. But as long as we deal with facts, we can have no argument. And so I could say, is it a fact you could die tonight? Yes, that's a fact. There's no argument about that. Is it a fact that if you did die tonight, your income would stop with you, with your death? There'd be no more earned income? Yes, that's a fact. Is it a fact that after your death that your family that live on will still need a continuation of income? Yes, that's a fact. Since there will be no earned income from you, then their income will have to come from some other source. Is that a fact? Is it a fact that the only other sources of income, the only sources of income that are in this world are three: time traded for dollars and dollars traded for things and services, your personal earning power, and two, capital invested at yield? And if you don't have either one of those, then the only other source of income is charity, the gifts from friends, relatives, or organized society. Now, if you've lost your personal earning power by death, if that's gone, and if you don't want your family to live on charity, the only other thing you can do is to create an estate, property invested at yield that will produce an income to substitute for your personal earning power. Is this a fact? Yes, that's a fact. then there has to be property. And if there isn't any property there, there just won't be any income. And so the problem is to get some property that will produce some income to take your place of your earning power if you should be taken away tonight. And you could go tonight. Is that whose problem is that? Is that your wife's problem, your children's problem, your next door neighbor's problem, your relative's problem, society's problem? Is that your problem? And if you don't do anything about it, there just won't be any property there. And there just won't be any income. And it isn't what anybody else thinks about it, it's what you think about it and what you do about it. And so I want to challenge you people here today with this stewardship responsibility. Does your program take dollars? Do those dollars come from people who become interested in your program and satisfied with it, and they continue their interest and continue their giving because they're wrapped up in it? If you don't get to them and create that interest and desire, they'll have no need, no desire to give. And you won't have any income. Is that a fact? Is that your problem? And if you don't do something about it in an organized fashion, nothing is going to be done about it. I've had the experience of helping organizations to increase their regular giving. I've had the experience of helping people increase their capital funds in amounts of $80,000, which is the smallest campaign, to $3.5 million, on some basic principles that I've learned that I'd like to share with you today. Now, whether this background of experience gives me any special vantage point from which to speak for this effort, I'm not quite sure. But I'm determined to speak from some vantage point, and this one at least has the advantage of being my very own. I know a great deal about it because I went through this particular one. I know that in my own personal experience, and you pardon my talking about my own personal experience, that during the years when I enjoyed a good income, I was busy with the job mostly of money making and money accumulation. I recognized that I was an integral part of the community. I recognized that I was a child of God. I recognized that I had obligations to family, and after discharging these, I concerned myself with my contributions to the community, to charity, and to church. And because I was so preoccupied and totally occupied with my life work of money making and estate accumulation, I was a very loose and a very careless giver. People could come to me and I hadn't time to listen to their proposition. I hadn't time to become involved in their activity. I wanted to buy my way out, and I contributed something to that particular issue. Advertising people and those who prepared literature and direct mail material that came across my desk were most adept at grabbing my attention quickly and getting a small contribution and donation. And then one day I retired from active money making and accumulation, and I was going to live on that which I had accumulated and find something else to do that was interesting and exciting and with my time. And these renewal applications for renewing subscriptions came across my desk, and I said to myself, for the first time in my life, think of it, at retirement. No one had brought me this picture before. At retirement, I said, for myself, I must give some thought and attention to being a good steward of the Lord's money that I give back. And I began to examine the literature that came to my desk and ask myself, as each one came across my desk, am I giving these people the proper proportion of my total giving? For the first time in my life. And I ask myself, which of these dollars is doing the most of what it proposes to do? These people all tell a good story about the great need. They all tell a good story about what they do with the money that they raise. I wonder how much of what they say can be borne out by the facts. And so for my personal use, I started a little investigation. I ask myself the basic question, what is the stated purpose of this organization? And do I really go for it? Is it something I could get excited about, be a participant in, contribute some time to, as well as some money for? What is its stated purpose? And am I sure that it'll always be that same purpose? Secondly, what is their performance record versus promises? What is performance versus promise? And you know, I found that few could tell me clearly, succinctly, and precisely exactly what their purpose was in language that I could understand it. Painting a word depiction that was inspiring and challenging, that I wanted to have a part in it. Just two short years ago, I was invited to accompany another gentleman up to Arrowhead Springs to Campus Crusade for Christ. I sat down at a lunch table, and at each place at that lunch table was a circular. It just had one line on it. And it all through the luncheon, it kept drumming itself into me. You can have a part. You can have a part. You know, in all the giving that I had ever been asked to do, no one had ever said to me in all my life, Gastel, you can have a part in this total program. On the inside, it told what I could have a part in. There wasn't very much mention, if any, about money. I could have a piece of the program. I could choose the particular piece that I felt I could contribute most to. I could have a part. And you know, it's a wonderful thing that you can get, as I have since that time, gotten before groups of people and to say to them, there is no one in this audience so destitute that you can't contribute something of value, something that's needed, a place to fill, time, talent, or treasure. And treasure lies. Because where you put in your time and your talent and your interest, there will your treasure go also. If you put in your treasure only, your interest may be only in your treasure. How, are you sure? Let's identify the problem. Are you sure that if I ask you to paint for me a word picture of what your purposes, aims, ambitions, goals were, and what the job would look like when it was finished, could you tell me clearly and precisely just what your purposes and objectives were now, and that they would always be the same? If I got started in it or contributed to it, would it be the same tomorrow as it is today? And how about your performance in relationship to your stated purpose? Are you making a 7-league boot step in the direction of your program? Or are you just creating a lot of dust by a lot of activity, running in a circle and going nowhere? If you could tell me clearly. The second thing I said to myself is, if I'm going to get involved in this organization, what is the depth of leadership not what is the leadership. Because I've been disappointed by some leaders that I have followed. I've had some people that I admired greatly and who were terrific performers and who deserved my support, but they neglected a vital thing. The recognition that they were not everlasting and would not live on infinitely on this earth, in this life. And there was no one to come on after them. And so they couldn't tell me that there was any dedication of purpose beyond the leader. That they didn't have capable ability, courage, conviction, and dedication to the purpose, even though, no matter how well stated, was but the purpose of an individual and not a dedication of all. And even in those cases where they had an adequate staff, people loaded down with talent and ability, the main objective and purpose was not communicated so that anybody but the leader could communicate it clearly and with an equal feeling that you got of his dedication other than from the mouth of the leader. And third, I ask myself, what of their financial responsibility? I wonder how much it costs, I ask. I wonder how much it costs these people to raise their money. And I began an investigation, and this was a hard one to uncover. And not because people were deceitful always somewhere. Most of them didn't know how many cents it cost to raise a dollar. They didn't keep records. But I found that in the 42 organizations that I had been contributing a buck or two, that the cost varied from 3 cents out of every dollar to 96 cents out of every dollar just to raise the fund. Now, gentlemen, these are some things that the larger giver is going to be concerned with. Now you can get $2 and $5 and $10 gifts, the kind I used to make from busy men without doing it. But you asked me to talk about how do you get the bigger people to think bigger and give bigger towards your particular effort. Then I asked myself another very pertinent and germane question related thereto. How much of the dollar that they actually have net after the cost of raising the money actually goes for the program that their stated purpose indicates is their program? And this was ever so much more difficult to find out. Organizations just don't keep that kind of records on what it costs them to produce their program by units of program activity. But of those that I was able to check, 31... of the actual dollar net after the cost of raising it, it varied from 8 cents to 94 cents was actually spent on the program. No efficiency, no cost control, no record keeping, no organized purchasing, no effort to get contributions in merchandise and services, pay the top price for everything and buy it always in a panic. Seems to be the general rule. I think probably more than any other group in organized society, charitable and Christian organizations exemplify the principle, come easy, go easy. They didn't labor and sweat and toil. The dollar came easy, in some cases by glib talking, emotional appeals, and they weren't the stewards of its spending that would justify my confidence in them, that I would eliminate others and pool my contributions to those that could do the more. In the course of this investigation, I talked with a number of people, some of whom had been clients of mine for many years, about their giving, about their concern in their giving. And I discovered a number of things, but they fell in these same three brackets. The reason these people were not giving more was not because they didn't want to give more, and not because they weren't able to give more, but because they couldn't satisfy their conscience that they were doing the right thing, the best thing, and so they were postponing and procrastinating doing anything at all. I had the experience with Campus Crusade for Christ to go on a flying squadron, we called it, around the United States, and we visited 14 cities, I believe it was, in 18 days, and had three groups in each city. And I was the tail ender on the program to talk to people about, after we had explained to them what the program was and what the need and what the opportunity of giving time and talent, then I talked to them about the privileges and the pleasure and the full sense of fulfillment in giving of their treasure. And I found one thing common. These were the biggest people in each city who had been gotten together to hear the story of what was going on here in this particular movement, in this particular activity. How God was blessing it. How the program was growing. What the statistics and the facts and accountability were. And I said that as I meet people around these United States, I hear one question over and over and over again. And I must hear it constantly because nobody is giving them the answer. People were saying to me, Gaskell, how can I give more? How can I give more? On the one hand, everything that I buy costs more. Every person I pay wages to has to receive more in order to maintain his standard of living. The costs of everything are going up and up on this hand. And on this hand, taxes and costs of government are going up. And I'm in a bind. I'm in a squeeze between increasing costs and increasing taxes and lowered net spendable income for myself. And though I want to give more, how can I give more? I built an estate planning organization dedicated to serve the top 10 or 15% of society who had the big incomes and the big estates because they had the big problem. And they didn't know how to answer. And the pitch that we made with these people was we called on them and we said, look, my friend, you're busy with the job of making money and I'm busy in the job of money management. I'd be glad to come in and take a look at your situation and bring to bear all of the knowledge and information that we have gathered on how other men have answered exactly the same problem. I bring to you a service which involves 5 points. I'll show you how to make more money. I'll show you how to spend it more wisely and to have a better standard of living at less cost because you spend more wisely. I can show you how to retain more net of what you do make net after income taxes by paying less income taxes, not less than you owe, but less than you're paying because you don't know how to avoid the taxes, not evade, but avoid. And the law makes provisions for tax avoidance. I'll help you identify what your total financial problem of life is and take its measurement and buy exactly the kind of property that will do the best job for the least money. I'll design a plan for the use and enjoyment of funds for those who live after you and finally distribute it to those that you would like it to go to permanently. I'll do it all without fee or cost or obligation, and I'll say to you now, that while I make my living selling life insurance, and I do that because in every situation I've ever investigated, additional life insurance is a requirement of the program, and they have to buy it from somebody, and I believe the people would rather buy it from me after I've shown them and helped them in this way than to buy it from anybody else if it costs them no more. But I want to promise you one thing. I'll never ask you to buy a nickel's worth of life insurance for me until first I have demonstrated to you that I can make your cash and your income do a better job than it's now doing, and I have discovered money that you don't now have that we can put into more life insurance to guarantee that what you do have, you can have always. I'll never ask you to buy a nickel's worth of my product until first I have demonstrated to you, the sole judge and jury, that you have income that you don't now know you have. I can uncover income, capacity to pay for more life insurance that you don't now have. Why shouldn't we be doing that in our activity and effort? Why shouldn't we be going into people who want to know how they can give more and have it cost them less, and show them how they can do more with the blessings that God has bestowed on them in generous supply? That they want to give more. People want to give more, and all they ask you and me is how? How can I? And we're not showing them how. We're just going and begging them to do without, to give up, to forego, to sacrifice, all of which is totally unnecessary. If you become astute trainers and instructors in charitable giving, on this particular visit, we talked to mostly millionaires, people who were generous, many of them to a fault. And we said to them one thing: if you'd like to know how to, if you'd like to know how you can do more for the things in which you're interested and have and live better, we can show you how to, with this understanding that if we can create in you a capacity to give greater than your present capacity to give without any self-sacrifice whatsoever, we're going to be the ones who decide where the giving goes. Now, that's a pretty good way to raise money, because you create in these people a capacity through your services that they can give more. That's what they want to do. You're a blessing to them. And you can show them how they can give more. Then the second question is, how can I give more? And then, secondly, how can I give more confidently that what I give will be used to the largest degree possible in the way that it was intended? Oh, so many people have come to me and said, Walter, I only wish I could get that money back. I became involved in this particular organization when its objectives were fine. Its motivations were good, and I contributed generously, and now they're 180 degrees in the opposite direction. They're 180 degrees in the opposite. I wish I could get my money back. I have no satisfaction, no joy in giving. How can I give more confidently that the purposes to which I gave are going to be fulfilled in part by my contribution of time or talent thereto? How can I give more selectively, as between comparative organization and the financial state? How can I read the financial statements to be sure that the money goes in the direction that I wanted it to go? Out of this experience that I had on this particular trip, came home with all of the facts necessary to make a charitable giving analysis of people who wanted to give more but didn't know how to. 38 instances of millionaires Everyone who gave me all of the financial facts related to his affairs and asked for advice and counsel on how to and how he could give substantially more and yet not impair his standard of living, actually increase his standard. Now, that's a great joy. And that's what all of us here should be confirmed with. In my own particular case, when I retired, my source of earned income ceased and I began living on accumulated assets. The assets that I had during my active business life had to be a different character of assets than after retirement, because during my active business life, I had earned income more than adequate for my needs. I was saving some of it every year. And after retirement, the picture changes. To have earned money on my accumulations and savings during my active years would have only gone for taxation. And now we want to turn on the income, and so we want a different character of property. Taxes are different. Giving has to be adjusted. And so in this particular area, I became concerned with investigating the sources. I wanted to know the stated purpose of every organization that I was contributing to. And so I ask you this morning, do you have such a succinct, precise, clear, and unchangeable, and unequivocal, and unrevocable stated purpose that you could present to me today? I wanted to know, secondly, to what extent were their performance and their promises matching up? It's one thing to seek my income based upon a promise of performance and never a report of performances versus promises. Few could tell me clearly the depth of their leadership. Was it one man of tremendous talent, or was it a team effort? Few could tell me that all were as deeply dedicated to purpose as was the leader. Few could tell me who had the power to dictate change, in whom or what body or organization was vested to dictate change. Particularly change that would change the purpose for the money that I might contribute. Generally, the objectives, the vision, the concept of the leader was never reduced to understandable language that could be communicated down the line to the newest recruit in the army. And so I ask you this morning, have you got that for me? How deep was the leadership? And what about their financial money-raising capacity? What was it costing them to raise the money? I wonder if you wouldn't be interested in making a survey sometime as you gather together, or having an auditing firm make a comparative analysis of the cost of just the men who sit in this room, represent various organizations. How many cents out of every dollar contributed actually goes to the program? And how many goes to administration, unnecessarily heavy cost, ostentation, or just the plain cost of raising the money? The cost to raise money varies in organizations that I've investigated from 3 cents out of every dollar to 96 cents. 3 cents out of every dollar to 96 cents. You know what I found? I found that I was contributing during much of my business life to an organization that maintained a mission among the Jews in Jerusalem. And they had a terrific program. They mailed something to me constantly. They told me it's pictures, oh, beautiful pictures of the poor people trudging back to Jerusalem. And they had a beautiful appeal. They got money. They had a mission in Jerusalem, a mission over there, converting the Jews. Think of it.
A woman who had a lockbox at the post office and earned her living as a tailor in a tailor shop and went to the post office and collected the mail. That was their mission in Jerusalem. $0.98 out of every dollar they raised never saw Jerusalem. Never won a soul to the Lord Jesus Christ. But boy, they had beautiful literature. My, they had a powerful radio appeal. Motivating letters. Tear-jerking pictures. They were effective, self-serving organization. So I want to know, how can I give more, and how can I give more confidently, and how can I give more selectively? And so I want to talk to you in the next time I get a chance to talk about some things that you can do to ensure me and other prospective givers who represent 90% of all the giving strength you can appeal to, the selective giver, how you can develop a program of giving that will get to these particular people a sense of accomplishment with their income. A sense of accomplishment with their income. In order to do this, you must first see clearly. You must develop your aim, your objective, your dream fully. See it clearly. Paint a picture. All of it. The finished job. How often you call on people call on you and you say to forgiving, and you say to them, now tell me, what is your total objective? What is this job going to look like when it's done? And they can only tell you what they see today. They're making up their plans as they go along day by day. They have no total vision of the total job. And so I would say to you, plan carefully every step. Develop for yourself a manual of operations and see that everybody who is a part of it understands the place that he has. Have a job description that you can share with me so that I know that you're organized and everybody has a place to fill and a job description and works as a member of the team in his particular job. Tell me what your principles and practices of operation are. And tell me what your performance record, based upon its relationship to the principles, practices, aims, and objectives that your organization stands for and hopes to accomplish. Show me a picture of the finished product, with all of the detail and all the ramifications and inspiring vision. And show me that you've a charted path from where you are to where you want to go. And then give me your boiled down plan for the next 5 years. Each year, a step in the direction of your ultimate vision and goal. And show me what you can do this year as an integral part of that particular plan. And then show me specifically what part I can play in it. Put me in the picture. For I must see it clearly. You must plan it carefully. And you must convince me that you believe in it thoroughly, and that you will faithfully hold fast to it. all of it, and that all are dedicated. Because, you see, believing makes it so. Believing makes it so. And out of believing will come action. Once you have painted the picture, once you see what you want to accomplish, once you've reduced it to writing so that you can convey it to other people who would like to share in that objective, then act today as though it were already an accomplished fact, because you believe that the Lord will bless your effort and bring to reality that which you can see clearly, plan thoroughly, and execute with confidence and with conviction. Behind it, build a staff with capacity to stretch. Oh, how pitiful we are. How pitiful the records of Christian organizations are. How pitiful the records are of failure to perform up to standards. Whether it be in the spending of money, whether it be in the performance of described, specified duties. We don't have to accept onto our staff and into our organization people of little competence. May have a big heart. They may have a big desire, but no ability to fulfill it. Clutter up the way. Ability to perform. Ability to stretch. And be selective in those people. A depth of dedication. It's been my unfortunate experience to visit with many leaders of fine, dedicated Christian organizations. And as I talked with the leader of that organization, I became inspired. And as I met with the lieutenants of that leader, I found none who were as inspired as I were. How far down the line have you shared the total aim, the end result, the final picture, the soundness of thinking and the ways and means of getting from where you are today to where you want to go? How much bickering is there to take charge and leadership for personal aggrandizement, a gain? Self-satisfaction instead of selfless service to the Lord. You men are in charge. I take it at the stewardship department of your organization. You want to build a team. Like organizing an army. You have the executive division. The troops that are actually on the firing line. But they're not going to stay on the firing line very long unless they have a stewardship department, a supply corps. They're sending up the food for the man and the ammunition for the enemy. And in most armies, for every one man on the front line, there are 8 to 10 in the backup forces. And the administration, the chief of staff, and the secretary of war. Do you understand it all? Have you a plan of stewardship? Before we talk about the ways and means of raising money, before we talk about the tools of the trade in money solicitation and support development,
Let's ask ourselves some serious question. Do you see clearly what it is you hope to accomplish? Have you reduced to paper the qualifications of the people that you will give the responsibility for leadership, so that each knows his own particular area of responsibility, sole responsibility, his area of cooperative responsibility, his area of shared responsibility? Is this in your organization chart? You're not ready to go out and ask me to contribute to your particular cause and your particular mission until you tell me you're organized. That you know what your mission and your objective is clearly and precisely, and you can challenge and inspire me that I want a piece, a part in that particular program, and that I would give of my time and my energy and my substance to have a part, the privilege of having a part. You don't beg me for a part. You challenge me to a part. Fight to get in there and be a piece of what you're trying to do. And then your stewardship. You never ask, but what you know how, where it's going to be spent, how it's going to be spent, and exactly what results are to come from it. Oh, I would ask you to concern yourself first with your purpose and be able to share it. First with your schedule of goals, markers along the highway that you're going to take in a single, unchangeable, uncompromising direction. That no insidious influence could get in and alter and change even a little tiny bit. That you're going to bring that through to a successful conclusion, and you inspire me to be a soldier, either in the front ranks, or if that isn't my God-given talent, then in the supply corps. Or in just working to raise the money to put in the hands of the supply corps to keep those fighting men on the firing line. Thank you very much. I had the experience of listening to the questions last night. This age in life, when I can't read the lips, I can't always hear what's said. I can't see far enough to read the lips. But I did hear some questions that made me wonder if what I had prepared to talk with you about were the things that were most helpful, most needed. I heard stories that needed advice of an attorney. And I wondered if attorneys aren't attracted to our program and want to give of their knowledge and their substance. I heard questions asked about investment programs, and I wondered if we didn't have investment men who were interested in the salvation of the world and the program that you and I are interested in. So I come to you this morning like I had an experience not too long ago. We had a new minister come to our church, and new assistant pastor. And they had a reception for him after the evening service, and served coffee and cookies, and they had a receiving line. And as the various members of the church came along, the senior pastor was introducing each couple or each individual as he came by and tried to say something germane and pertinent to the particular introduction. And when Maud and I came by, he said, Reverend, I'd like to have you meet Mr. and Mrs. Gastel, Maud and Walter Gastel. And this little lady has been married to the same man for more than 45 years. And Maud spoke up real quickly and said, I'd have you know he's not the same man.
Well, I have to acknowledge there's been some doctoring done, and that she was the doctor and should have the degree. And so I've doctored up the things that I thought I would talk with you about today and brought you some new ideas, because I feel that there's a need here among people who are concerned with raising money principally and are forgetting the fact that all that is God's. And they don't understand. We don't understand, or we didn't reflect, you didn't reflect to me in the meeting last night, a complete understanding of your opportunity as well as your responsibility as the head of stewardship in your particular organization. A lack of understanding of how life is lived and how we're born into this world and what we're equipped with and what we can do with as we are given the power to choose to do with that which is ours. I think we need to know three or four basic laws in order to get ourselves in a good mental frame of mind to do this job. And so I want to talk a little bit. They say that the raising of money or the achieving of financial success is spelled K-A-S-H, cash. K stands for knowledge. A stands for attitude. S stands for skill. And H stands for reducing the whole process to an habitual subconscious performance. And I don't doubt but what a lot of you gentlemen here have a great deal more knowledge about the laws of taxation and the exemptions of gifts and how to create trusts and wills and a lot of other things that are necessary in the stewardship department, knowledge. I don't doubt but what you have great skill in presenting the program of your particular organization and what its aims and objectives are and how you propose to fulfill them and what the need is in dollars and cents and your sense of dedicated stewardship to the particular program that you're in and why I should want a part in that program. And I don't doubt but what each of you have established some sort of a habit of daily performance by which you accomplish more or less. I think we need to stop and realize that God and his great plan for man on the face of the earth, man, God's greatest creation, the most mysterious of all, that he had a plan for you and for me. We didn't happen here on this earth by accident. We're not here without rhyme or reason. And so you're here for a reason. You were born of particular parents because those particular two people possessed a combination of genes which could put into you the particular quotient of the particular ingredients that you needed within your life to do the job that you were created to do. I can't believe that there's less of perfection in the creation of each than that. I can't believe for one single second that I was born into this world without rhyme or reason, or that I was born ill-equipped to do a howling successful job of the thing I was brought here to do. You know, I presume you daydream, I daydream. Even at this age. There's a similarity to every daydream I've ever had. Everyone is like everyone that went before. You know, the two things particularly. First, I'm the central figure in every daydream I ever had. And you know another thing? I've never had one turn out badly. And you suppose for one second that a gracious father would put me down in this earth, on this earth, with a power to dream of achievement and accomplishment and doing good and doing it well, only to be frustrated, disappointed, disillusioned, defeated, incapable of accomplishing that which I was sent here to do? No. Now, when I was born into this world like a little sea mustard seed, in me was all the ingredients necessary to make a howling success of the thing I was here to do, if I would but ask God what it is and give what I had to developing that which is in me. Another thing it took me a long time to learn, I've always been a rather egotistical soul. I hired men for the life insurance business. I hired them. I didn't. They were attracted to me. They saw in me something they wanted, something they could work with, something they could benefit by, and so they associated themselves with me, and it wasn't my power of persuasion, and if it were, then I undoubtedly brought men with me who should have been with someone else, and they didn't do as well with me as they could have done with someone else. And I was frustrating the will of God. But I never added one single thing to any man that I used to talk about the men that I trained, the men that I inspired, their achievements as though they were mine. And you know, I have never in all my life done anything for anybody else. You know, one of the great pities is that we as a nation are trying to see how much we can do for the peoples of the world. And everything we do for them weakens them. And the only power I have is the power to inspire people to do right for themselves. And in doing, exercise their God-given talent that it might grow. It's important to me to know that there can be no growth without activity, and that the end of growth is death, and after death is decay. That in order to stay good, I've got to constantly strive to get better. And the only way I can get better than those that are associated with me is to try to do my particular job that I think is the thing for me to do and try to do it better and better and get everybody else to do it. Now, if I learn those particular laws, if I invest what God gave me and use it and multiply it, and if I don't, what will happen? It'll be taken away. As the talent was taken away from he who hid it in the ground. And who was it given to? The man with two talents? No, the one with five. And how did he get five into 10 and 10 into 20? By using them. By using them. And I think we need to know that that is the law of growth, that the law of growth is based on use. And that I must, in order to get, I must first give. That getting comes from giving. Oh, let's take a simple illustration. You send your youngsters to school for an education. How do they get an education? They must give. They must give attendance, attention, concentration, application. And they get back knowledge, education, in direct proportion to the attendance, attention, application that they give. Two kids sit in the same class. They don't graduate with the same grades. They don't have the same quantity of knowledge they got out of a year spent in the classroom under exactly the same teacher in exactly the same environment, because one kid was looking out the window and wishing he could be out there fishing or doing something else, and the other kid was paying attention. Just the difference in attention or concentration or application. And that made the total difference. And we need to remember that out of this process of which man is created and born into this world and grows and expands, that he develops the capacity to do something not for self, but to do something for someone else, and that man is the only animal created by God who has the power of doing anything for anybody else. All other animals are totally self-serving. And that must mean something to us. That each of us should choose some one thing that we can learn to do better than anybody else can do, and do that for many other people while he learns to do something for you and for me. And so I do very little for myself, and you do very little for yourself, and the business of living is to do for each other. And as I learn to improve the value of my time and learn to do what it is that I am chosen and maybe selected to do, that I can do it better and better day by day, quantitatively and qualitatively, by increasing my skill and efficiency in doing it and increasing my knowledge as to how to do it bigger and better in serving other people more and more, I gain a value of my time.
My time has no value to me. My time is only valuable as I employ it in the service of other people. Oh, I wish I could develop these things, but I must move on fast because I've got a lot to cover here. To get a proper attitude towards this job that is yours and mine, this job of stewardship. But that time, by the use of my time in trying to perfect a God-given talent, I create value in time and value in my talent. Talent to serve other people in some particular peculiar way. And since I can earn by the proper development of my time and my talent, I can earn more than I need for myself. I accumulate a substitute for earning power, which we call men's wealth, their estates, their property. And the only purpose in the world for ownership of property is that someday your property will step into your shoes and do the job that you now do of trading time for dollars and dollars for things and services, and that's the way we live. And some of us have learned to do it. Some of you have learned to do it better than others. And so your time is very valuable, and you use it very importantly. And you don't use your time doing something that someone else can do better for you in less time. But you use your time in doing for yourself and for other people that thing which you're particularly skillful and particularly endowed to do that particular thing. And then if you understand from whence cometh everything, and that you owe nothing, not time, no matter how much or how little is left to you, none of it is yours. You can't be sure of another hour. You possess no time, no talent. Everything you have in the way of talent was given to you at birth, and you just brought out that which was there. You developed by exercise and use as you developed the muscle in that arm by using it, and it would wither if you didn't use it. If somebody had made every motion for you and lifted everything that you had to lift, and that arm would be no good. You can't do anything for people. The only thing you can do is to get them to do for themselves. And you haven't spent all you've made, and you've laid up some treasure. And now whose is it? And for whom should it be employed? And how long can you keep it? Now let's turn it to stewardship. You're dealing with people under these laws who have time. Time to give. Time to share. Time to employ. Either to employ it directly in proclaiming the gospel, or trading time in the service of men in other walks for which they receive dollars of compensation remuneration and giving the dollar. Talent. Your talent? No. God's talent. Your treasure. How can you have any lack of understanding? Any question about your right, the privilege that is yours, the benefit you will bestow on the recipient if you give him an opportunity to give his time, his talent, and his treasure. Not just his treasure. It's so little that most people have to give. I recently had the privilege of appearing before business executives, leading businessmen, and the wealthiest people in each community. We were making a flying squadron trip for Campus Crusade for Christ, and we visited a number of cities to tell them of the program, what the accomplishments were, and what the needs were. I became involved in this particular program in a rather unique way, personally, in that I was a consultant to a businessman, and I had prepared for him a report that I needed to present, but he was so busy with the Lord's work that he never had any time. This particular businessman believes this doctrine and practices it in that he spends less than 10% of his time in his business and 90% in the large way. And he has the most successful business you ever saw. And he said to me, Wally, called me on the phone long distance. He said, Wally, I just got to get that report because we've got to start initiating some of those things you're planning for us. And I've got to go over it with you, but I just don't have any time. But I've got to come out to California, and I've got to go up to Arrowhead Springs for give a couple of talks at Campus Crusade for Christ. And I said, what's that? And he said, that's an organization. I want to tell you about it, but it occurs to me, you know where it is? And I said, no, I don't. He says, it's a San Bernardino. I said, I know where that is. It's the Arrowhead Springs Hotel. I said, I've been there many times when it was a hotel. Well, he said, could you meet me at the airport and drive me up there? How long would that take? I said, about an hour and a half. He said, that'd give us an hour and a half for talk. And we can drive back, and that'll be another hour and a half, and maybe we can catch a couple of hours while we're up there and talk about this plan that you've worked out for us. And, well, you know, I work on a fee basis, on an hourly basis, and I figured out an hour and a half going up there and an hour and a half coming back and a couple of hours up there, and I figured out what, yes, and I said, oh, yes, I'd be glad to drive you up there. I got up there and I got interested in what I saw. And I sat down at the lunch table and there was a little leaflet there in front of me that had a slogan on it. That somehow, maybe my heart had been prepared, but that slogan meant more to me than any series of words, in that both the challenge and the joy it brought to me. And it read, you can have a part. You can have a part. And I said to myself, me? Walter Gastel can have a part in this program? Because the program was to fulfill the Great Commission in this generation. You can have a part? And then I said, what part? What did they have need of that I could do? And then this business executive said to me, Anna, please pardon my talking about myself personally. I can only speak about experience, and the only experience I have is my personal experience. This business executive pointed out their need in this organization for the very things that I had done for him in the organization of his business with lines of command and committees and duties and job specifications and areas of responsibility and limits of accountability and authority. And he said to Dr. Bright, Bill, this man's done a wonderful job for me, the thing I desperately needed. And it occurs to me that you people here at Campus Crusade for Christ need this ever so much more than I need it. Why don't you get this fellow to give some of what God has given him in a peculiar capacity and talent for seeing the problem clearly, diagnosis and analyzing it, trotting up against the problem all possible solutions and picking the best probable solution, and then convincing the other person that this is the way to do it and giving them the conviction that it will work, and they go and do it that way. And it works. Not because it's the best solution, but because they believe it is. And believing makes it so. Oh, how important that is. Believing makes it so. I have had men working for me come in and say, I went out to do this job for this man. And I said this, and he said, I knew when I went out there that this was the ideal solution for him, that he would buy it and pay for it and thank me for bringing it to his attention. I left him, and he turned it down, and I don't know why. What did I do wrong, Walter? I said this, and he said that, and I said this, and he said that. What do I do now? And I said, well, now I tell you what I think I'd do if I were in your shoes. I'd do this and do this and say this and say this. Now you go do that and you'll get the results you're after. And if you said, I believe you're right, I'll do it exactly that way. And he went out and did it as nearly as he could exactly that way, and it worked. And another man came to me with exactly the same problem. And I gave him exactly the same instruction as to what to do. And he said, well, now, are you sure? Do you really think that'll work? He might say something else. He might turn him this way. It might not do. But I'll go do it. I'll try. I'll do what you tell me to do. It never worked. It never worked. Oh, gentlemen, I have seen men believe their beliefs and doubt their doubts. Believing all their beliefs and doubting all their doubts and accomplish almost the impossible miracles. And no miracle was ever performed without complete belief. And then I've seen a little tiny insidious doubt creep in, just a little bit. And I've seen the same man begin to believe his doubts, the work of the devil, until he believed more and more of his doubts and doubted more and more of his belief, and the same man failed completely. Now, this man that has come into your realm, into your sphere, you can prove to him, you can show him, you can convince him that all he has is of the Lord. His time, his talent, and his treasure. And that you come to him not to ask, but to give. To give him the opportunity of using some of this, and in using it, have it grow. And so that he has greater capacity to do more, either quantitatively or qualitatively, and to make more. And our work of helping people who want to give more and yet live better, have more left. I talked to a dentist not so very long ago, and he said, I want to give more of my time to the Lord's work, and yet I have so many obligations and responsibilities to family and children to be educated and all these other things and a standard of living to maintain, and my dental practice takes too much time. Orthodontist. Very skilled man. And I said, well, this is simple. How much do you need to make? Why don't you learn to make it in half the time and give the other half of the time to the Lord? He said, how do I do that? I said, merely analyze all the things that you do in a day, and which is worth $10 an hour, and which is worth 20, and which is worth 30, and which is worth 40, and which is worth 50, and get other people who can only do $10 jobs to do your $10 work. And so he built a clinic. I told him how and where to go and get the people who wanted to specialize in the big, got a hygienist. And she did a much better job cleaning people's teeth than he did, but he always came in and examined them to see if there were any fillings that needed to be placed or anything that needed to be done. And because of his great reputation, she was busy morning, noon, and night cleaning people's teeth. And she alone paid his total overhead, so he had no overhead. And he got another dentist who wanted to fill teeth, that all he wanted to do, another dentist who wanted to make false teeth. And they moved in with him. And he had his own laboratory. And he's making twice as much as he ever made. And giving over half his time to the Lord. This comes out of an understanding of how life is set up. There isn't an attorney in this world who isn't a joiner of more organizations, who isn't trying to get elected to office in every organization so he can get up in front of them? Why? Because it's unethical to solicit law practice. How do people come to you if they don't know that you're in existence and that you practice law? For Pete's sake, give these people a chance to expose themselves and their legal acumen. Give his time, as the dentist did. And because he's given time, he's being exposed. And because he's always introduced as the world's most famous orthodontist of the South and this and that and the other thing, they're coming to him from all over the place and they pay him four times what they'd pay the local guy. And what about trust companies and trust services? What about life insurance people? What about business consultants? Management people? You see, Bill Bright said to me, yes, I see we need what you do. Oh, how this organization, how God's program would be furthered if you'd come and give, if we could have your time and your know-how and your experience and your ability to do this for us. What a terrific thing it would be to us. But it's out of the question. A man in your profession, we couldn't afford to pay your fee. We couldn't afford to pay your fee. And I said, oh, that's purely an academic discussion. I can't give you any time. I'm already booked 120% of my time. How could I do any more? And then this business executive, this president of a company, turned to me and he said, Walter, may I ask you a question? How much on your schedule have you got us booked for, my corporation? I said, well, I've got my schedule worked out and it's a week a month for the next 7 months. And he said to me, if we would postpone our job for 7 months, could you make those 7 weeks available to Campus Crusade for Christ? We can forego. God will see that nothing happens to my business. We'll postpone our work if you'll give your time, thought, and talent. Employ your time, thought, and talent for the next 7 weeks, next 7 months, a week a month, for Campus Crusade for Christ. And I said, yes, but I couldn't get the job done in 7 months, starting from scratch. It would probably take me 12. He said, we'll postpone it 12 months. And then Bill Bright said to me, Walter, now we have the time. What about the price? And what do you suppose I could say? Can I charge God for giving back to him a little bit of what he's given to me? No, but what did it do for me? It gave me a fulfillment of giving that I couldn't have gotten any other way. Why are you denying these experts in your territory, in your community? These attorneys, these trust officers, these life insurance men, these business consultants, these investment counselors, these people who could set up endowments and trust funds and various plans and execute them for you. And you're not letting them grow. Don't you realize that all you can ever do for another is to give him an opportunity to develop himself? And to give of his time and his talent so that he'll develop the fullness thereof. That out of it will come treasure, which you'll want to divide in greater measure with you and your organization, if you can interest him in it. And then another thing I'd like to say to you, and this is on my subject, getting to the larger donors. And I don't want to leave that first part without assuring you that every time you go to see somebody about giving, whether you're giving him an opportunity to give his time and grow in his capacity so that he can do more with every hour of his day and get more enjoyment out of doing it, Oh, you know, there's an important law there. Do you know that if you don't enjoy what you're doing, you don't, not only don't do it well, but you don't get any enjoyment out of life. You don't get any health. People who are in love with their job don't have to force themselves to go to work every morning. Oh, I'd hate to get up in the morning and say, oh, for heaven's sakes, another day I have to go to work. Weren't enjoying what he was doing. What a terrific enjoyment you could give these people out of doing what they were doing and trying to do it more. That you're not going to ask. You're not out to get. Whoever you approach and whatever opportunity you give him to give of himself, you give him an opportunity. You're there to give, not to get. You're there to give him an opportunity to grow. Him an opportunity of sense of being worthwhile. Him an opportunity of giving back a little share of what he's so grateful for and says thanks for every morning but does nothing else about it. Except maybe to wish it were more. And the only way you can get more is to give away what you got so that you can handle more. If we could see this, you won't have any trouble building first your organizational structure, your stewardship department of the leading, most knowledgeable, most skillful, most influential people in your organization or in your interest, and they in turn will interest other people of like ilk. And these people will be grateful, everlastingly grateful, for the opportunity that you give them to grow in strength and in stature and in capacity to serve the Lord with their time and their talent and a larger, much larger measure of their treasure. Now, if we have the organization, and we have our proper committees appointed to do the various functions of an organization, and the stewardship department is not a one-way job when you go out on your fundraising campaign and everybody without any training turns to and helps out. It is not just getting the money in no matter how it takes or putting on a special drive for special funds. It's a constant job of education, and it's a constant job of stewardship. For yours is the responsibility of getting the organization to establish a long-range plan and break that down into five-year plan and that down into next year's plan, and next year's plan must be a growth over this year's achievement. Yours is to work out a system by which you can go out to the people who contributed and give them a sense of enjoyment out of their contribution and telling them that you did more than you promised to do with less money than they gave. And that you've added to the program for the next year and you're going to give them an additional opportunity to give more. Yours is the opportunity of building a budget and managing the expenditure of those funds. Setting up first an asking budget, getting it approved by the proper board that this is the program we want and this is the money it will take to put on the program and achieve the results we're after, and the achievement results is on a goal basis leading step by step to our long-range achievement. This is the stewardship's responsibility. Having had communicated to them what the total game is, and what part can be done this year, and this 5 years, and this 10 years? And see to it that you're on schedule. And communicate every move that you make. A stewardship job after the funds are raised, or after the money is in, or the score is counted, and you know whether you're over or under, you develop the working budget. And you give to those departments the portion thereof that each department needs to do its job, and ask them to turn in a budget for their department that would indicate good budget, good money management. Yours is the job during the year when this department isn't using its money to see that it doesn't lay there idle, but that this department, which could use more, gets transferred from that department over to this department, the necessary money to do the extra job. Oh, this is the fullness of storage. This is the importance of the stewardship department. And to see that competent and capable people are there, and that when it's time to raise next year's money, that you have something important to report on this year's achievement and some reason for asking for more for next year. Yours is the job to decide when additional facilities are necessary and capital funds are to be raised and what method is to be used. Yours it is to organize the people that will do it and inspire them to go and do it rather than to call in one of these fundraising organizations and pay them 10 or 15% for getting you to do, because you're going to do all the work anyway. They don't do a single thing except get you to do it. Yours is the job of going out and interviewing people and giving them the proper return on the gifts that they made by showing them what particular part they were responsible for. Relate them, their time, their talent, and their treasure to this part. You can have a part. This part of the achievement. And then that puts you in another very enviable position, where you can go back to that individual and you can say, I'm sure you recognize how grateful we are in this organization for the part that you play. It's a considerable part. If anything should happen to you, what would we do? Let's put it on a dollar and cents basis. This individual's contributing $10,000 a year. That's an important part of your total budget. Your budget is carefully planned and every dime, not alone every dollar, every dime is carefully spent. And this man drops out of the picture. You know, it's an interesting observation that all your deaths occur at the top of the ladder of giving. Most of your deaths occur at the top of the ladder of giving. Oh, what a job it is to replace a 10,000 giver. There isn't another 10,000 giver going to pop up. So you have to get $10,000 givers or $2,500 givers or $1,010 givers, you know? That's work. But did all the $10,000 givers start at $10,000 givers? Not at all. They grew from 10 to 100 to 500 to 1,000 to 10,000. And how? By somebody giving them the opportunity to have a bigger part and a greater sense of fulfillment and communicating that regularly to them. Then go back and say, what would we do? Oh, we honestly pray the Lord to spare you. You're so needed. You're so necessary. We'd have to give up part of the program. Maybe not your part, but some other part would have to suffer. For it would take us time to replace you. Wouldn't you like to leave this veil of tears in the knowledge that your part of the program would continue for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and give us time to build from within the capacity of other givers to take your place? And this is so easy. It would only take $50,000 of life insurance to continue your gift for the next 5 years, and you could say to the Board of Trustees, gentlemen, when you leave this world, you could send a little love note to the Board of Trustees and say, gentlemen, I not only made a pledge for this year, and I mean to keep it, but you can count on me for 5 more years. And the premium on the insurance policy that would guarantee it's deductible comes out ahead, and you're not taking a nickel away from your estate or your family or the other commitments that you've made. How many of you have used this terrific source of income to guarantee the completion of your program. You'd give people an opportunity to do so. Opportunities? Before I give all my time to Christian organizations, I worked in the life insurance business to help any kind of an organization that needed help. I found an Elks Club in Oakland, 1929, 30. They'd built a beautiful edifice. They'd borrowed the money to pay for it. They had to pay an important amount of the principal every year and 6% interest on the balance. Their income was down and they couldn't meet both the interest payments and the principal payments, and they were in trouble of losing it. And they came to me to ask if I knew of some insurance company that maybe would take over the loan on easier terms, and I said no, but I know how you can get rid of your problem. Answer your own problem. Well, how can we do that? So I said, every man who's a member of this Elks Club is going to die someday. And when he does, there's somebody, his executor's going to have to pay attorney's fees and executor's fees and probate fees and court costs and inheritance tax, estate inheritance tax, and federal estate tax. And all of these bills are going to, and his last illness and funeral expenses, and these bills are going to add up somewhere. For the poorest individual who's a member of this club, it would be at least $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. And for some of the rich ones, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. Every man who dies here on the day of his death needs cash to pay those bills. How would you like it if somebody came to you and said, I'll pay those bills for you? You can pay those bills now. I'll calculate them. You can pay them 50 cents on the dollar. I could do that. Because at the average age, I could sell you $1,000 worth of insurance for $500 single premium. But we'll not do that. We'll just agree, this Elks Club will agree with every member who needs money at his death that they will provide him the money of his death 2-for-1. 2-for-1. You tell me how much you need and I will provide it for you 2-for-1. You loan me half the money. You give me half the money. Because every man who knows that bill has got money laid away to pay that bill, so it'll be liquid and he won't have a forced sale on all the rest of his assets in order to pay that particular bill. And so their own members chucked in gladly. $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000. It was laying idle and non-productive because they were paying a $2,000, a $10,000, a $20,000, a $50,000 bill of debt, 2-for-1. Paying for it today, 50 cents on the dollar. And we won't give you any interest in the meantime, but it's your death, and if it could be tomorrow, we'll double your money, 2-for-1. Well, at the average age, it costs $30 a thousand to buy the insurance. $2,000 was $60. $60 is 6%. On $1,000, we took their $1,000 and paid it on the principal of the loan and released the 6% interest and no installment payments. And you know what I said to him? I said, gentlemen, if you don't pay the principal and the interest on this loan, if you pay interest only on the loan, the $600,000 loan, and if you paid the interest at 6% for the next 100 years, you'd still owe the $600,000, wouldn't you? Now, in my particular proposition that I'm making to you, gentlemen, you pay me the 6% that I pay for the insurance will be the same as the lodge would pay for interest only. The 6% you pay me. That's simple. But you only pay me 6% the first year because some of them are going to die the first year. And you only have to pay the insurance premiums on the balance of them. And so if you paid 6% the first year and zero the last year, your average rate of interest is 3%, not 6%. I cut your interest in half from 6% to 3%. But if you had paid 6% for 100 years, you'd still owe the principal, and my 3% pays both the principal and the interest. Of Because when the last guy dies, you don't owe any more principal. Well, that was a good sale for $1,200,000 worth of insurance. Just one talk to a group of men like this. I'd love to have done it for a Christian organization that was in debt $600,000. I went to a Masonic lodge and told they had solicited their members for donations to build a lodge, and they were concerned about when they'd have to rebuild it or redecorate it or repair it. And so they wanted a revolving fund. So we did a job for them. Just one meeting. Passed out the forms to sign up. How many of you people who have something to do with registering kids in college are concerned about those kids finishing what they start? I wonder how many of you are concerned about the fact that parents would sacrifice for years to stack up enough dollars to give their kid an education, and the kid is killed in an automobile accident the day before graduation, and they've lost the child, and they've lost all the purpose for their sacrifice and saving. And you don't care about it? You evidence to me that you don't care because you don't have a plan which is included in the tuition, which wouldn't cost over $20 or $25 a year, by which you could guarantee that every kid that dies while in college, we reimburse his family the $10,000 that they sacrificed and did without. And they'd give a lot of it back to the college. What is the biggest reason that kids drop out in college? The family can't foot the bill. And in most cases, it's because the breadwinner lost his job and the kid goes home to support mom and brothers and sisters. Statistics prove that to be fact. Why wouldn't you include in that package? Why wouldn't you include in that package a program on the father's life? That if the father goes, the kid gets to finish his college education. You can buy that in one of two ways, through an insurance company, where an important part of what you pay would have to go for selling the idea and sales costs, or you could form your own insurance company and pay no costs, and half of all the profit would accrue to the benefit of your organization. I wish we evangelical Christian organizations had the astuteness that the Mormons had. Oh, what an economically sound job they do. Every Mormon gives a part of his life to the church. Regularly a part of his income, he tithes. And every time they build a new edifice, they give that in addition because he gets no credit for his regular tithe. And they don't start the thing until they have all the money in hand. And they build it by giving labor. The contractor gives his time. The architect gives his time. The engineer gives his time. The laborers give their time, and many of the material dealers give the material at cost, if not totally give it. And somebody was talking here last night about a corporation that wanted to give more than 5%, and he didn't know how to tell them. Give services. Give material. Expense it out. Or give it without profit. Give the profit. Oh, there's so many things you could do. I called in an organization. A man showed me was interested in a college down in the South. He said, here is a concern that has been a great benefactor to this college, and they're over their limit of 5% giving. And these people were distributors of Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola, I don't remember now which. And they had 5-gallon steel drums where they delivered it to the soda fountain. And somebody had come along and shown them that they could save the price of the drum 10 times over in a very short period of time if they would convert to plastic drum. It didn't weigh so much, less shipping costs, less handling costs, put more of them on a truck, deliver them faster, all kinds of reasons why a plastic drum was an economical. And they switched over. And the whole yard was filled with steel drums, taking up space. Couldn't get anything hardly for them for junk. Well, it wasn't too difficult to find another organization that needed steel drum and couldn't use anything else but steel drum. Now, if the Coca-Cola distributor had sold his steel drums, which he depreciated to zero, it would have been 100% not capital gain, ordinary income, and taxable to him at 50 cents on the dollar. And furthermore, the other corporation, knowing that, wouldn't pay him. But in the name of the college, we went to the second corporation. Said, how would you like to buy some steel drums and have all the proceeds of what you pay for it go for the college? That was exciting to them. Now they were willing to pay a little bit more for the steel drums in order that they could give more, and they wanted to give more and didn't know how to deduct it. And so they paid a good price for the drums. And since they were depreciated to zero, the other company wrote them off without cheating their board of directors or stockholders. And we converted property into income for a college university. Oh, this field of getting people to give what they have that is useless to them. I found a woman who had an inherited estate from her parents and was complaining about the fact that everything she spent was costing her more, and her help cost her more, and she had a lot of help in her house, too. I'll tell you, that's another story. And her taxes were higher every year. And what am I going to do? I'd love to give more, but I can't. I'm suffering now. I don't see how next year I can give the $22,000 I gave last year. And that wasn't 30% of her income, which she was allowed. 30% was nearer $60,000. And so I said to her, let's take a look at your situation. And of course, the place I look at is not the income-producing property, but the income-costing property. To find out what they have that isn't producing them any income, but's producing a part of their expenses. And so I found that her father and her mother had a home, and it was next door to the church that they had gone to all their lives. And she was not taking any income on it because she wouldn't want to pay the income tax. She was letting the church use it as a rectory. Paying the taxes on it, paying the upkeep on it, and she couldn't deduct a nickel of it because she owned the property, not the church. And so I said to her, what about giving? Let's have the property of value. You never want it, do you? No, but I wouldn't want to sell it. I said, let's give it to the church. In my mother and father's home, they loved the church, didn't they? Oh, yes. Wouldn't they sing an extra hymn in glory if ye knew you gave it to the church? Of course they would. Let's give it to the church. $33,000 appraised value. $33,000 she could take off of her other income to build her up to her $60,000 she was allowed that year. And Uncle Sam gave her what? 70% of the money as a deduction, because she was in a 70% tax bracket on that top bracket. But not only that, she had $30,000 of spendable income, which she didn't have before. Complained to me about the fact that her butler, who'd been in the family, and his wife, who'd been in the family for years and years and years, and he'd had a heart attack. And now it was decided he never could come back to work. But he didn't have anything to live on. And she'd have to hire a new butler and a maid, another couple. Paid him $500 a month. We're still paying him $500 a month. We'd have to hire another one, and her expenses were going to go up $500 a month. $500 out there. It was such a simple thing to say to her. Why don't you retire him? Cost you less than $500 a month. In the first place, we can put him on disability Social Security, and that'll pay him $200 a month. You paid the Social Security tax for the last 15, 20 years. Now you're not going to collect it? So they put him under Social Security for $200 a month? And his wife? She took $18,000 and bought a joint life annuity, joint and two-thirds, to build up the other $3,000. And you know what she had out of the $18,000 of securities that was going in there? She had 5% income, 70% taxable. And now, you see, I relieved her of $500, which in her particular case is the income after taxes on $150,000 in her case. And it only cost her $18,000. The income on $18,000 of money she's otherwise using by using principal and interest. What are you doing? Giving to people.
That's right.
In order to get. Giving comes first. There is no getting unless first there is some giving. I'd like to talk to you about using these astute people who are interested in your organization to set up for you a tax-exempt trust so that those people who need to earn income and want tax-exempt income can put it in this common trust fund and get greater diversification, freedom from management, regular payment, and a great percentage of them, when they're through with the need of income, will leave the money to you. Set yourself up a taxable foundation for those who need growth development in their program. A mutual fund of your own. Get those people knowledgeable in this particular field to do it and get the joy of doing it for your organization. Get life insurance companies to set up a complete program of life insurance. Why can't you have a Presbyterian minister's fund, the greatest life insurance company in America, producing the insurance at the lowest price because they have no acquisition cost whatsoever? And because they have dedicated people who give their time without thought of $100,000 salaries. All they want is a good living to give their time and their lives to the Lord. Why can't you have a beneficial life insurance company? The Mormons have one, a very successful life insurance company. And maybe some of you who are sitting here are buying your insurance from them, for all you know. And helping support the Mormon church because they make a handsome profit. Now, other businesses don't do it. When Sears made buying over-the-counter of life insurance an economical way to buy insurance, and banks put in life insurance departments. Some of the great department stores like Bullock's and Federated and some of these, they bought life insurance companies. And they own them. On the other hand, one of the greatest organizations in America that practices private enterprise, where the individual store owner owns part of the store, J.C. Penney and Company. I just saw recently a beautiful ad. J.C. Penney Company, over-the-counter insurance, the best of coverage, the greatest of security, the lowest prices, all of this thing. Come and over-the-counter, we're at your service. And in fine print at the bottom, this program of insurance guaranteed and underwritten by the Beneficial Standard Life Insurance Company of Los Angeles, California. All they did was go to an existing life insurance company and say, it cost us more to set up a life insurance company. We don't have any knowledgeable people to do the inside job, but we've got a market. We can deliver the life insurance to you in great quantities, but we want it for ourselves. If there's any profit on it, we want it in any life insurance, any good life insurance company. I can name you five life insurance companies led by dedicated Christian men who would glory in the opportunity to set up your life insurance company at their cost, which would be a fraction of your cost, give you all the profit that is in it, and no acquisition cost to put the business on the books. What's the matter with us?
Our constituency is made up of the people who are doing these things and who would love to give their talent as well as their time and their treasure to the Lord.
Well, let's just stop for coffee and you'd be ready to carry on, would you?
Right.
Could you do with a cup of coffee?
I sure could.
Okay, that's great.
I'd like to close on this one note. Whatever your program, may it have four parts. See it clearly. Be sure you reduce your vision to details and specifics. See it clearly. Plan it thoroughly. Believe in it completely. And then act today as though it were already a proven fact. Have that faith in God. Thank you very much.